Welcome to the Smoke and Rope Podcast, the show that brings together Michigan's top cannabis growers, advocates, and business owners to offer a fresh and honest perspective of Michigan's cannabis industry. Stick with us to get the lowdown from the people who have been on the ground floor of cannabis business in Michigan and gain insights into where the industry may be heading. Welcome to the Smoke and Rope Podcast. Today is episode 19. I'm your host, Ryan Basor, and I'm excited to have on in the other room from where I'm sitting a good friend and not a co-worker, but we see each other every day, Josh Covert from Covert Law, also known as the Michigan Cannabis Defender. Josh, thanks for being on.
Hey, thanks, Ryan. Thanks for having me on.
You got it. And over in Lansing, Kevin at True Cannabis is with us again. Kevin, what's happening again today?
Oh, same old, buddy. Keeping the boat afloat.
All right. And Tom Beller up in Kalkaska. It's chilly up there. He's keeping warm. How you doing, Tom?
Sun is shining. It's a beautiful day. I'm excited for our guest today, man. What's up, Josh?
Hey, Tom. How's it going?
Great, man.
Cool. So a little bit about the history of when I first met Josh and knew about him. I actually started reading about Josh when I was in FCI Morgantown. I had the Lansing State Journal sent to me, and that was my ritual, was reading the paper. And I started reading about Josh Covert and what he was doing, and then the famous case of Free Bree that Josh ended up winning, took on pro bono. I was reading all about it, and it would just start seeing his name come up more and more, and it was cool. And I was excited to meet him when I got out. And when I did get out, I called on Josh. I had started doing social media and marketing for cannabis companies, and I went and met with Josh and hit it off and started working together from the get-go, and that went well. And then watched Josh, you know, he worked on so many of the first Section 8 defenses in Oakland, Kent counties, some of the tough ones. Watched him travel all over the state for people, whether they could pay or not, and have all these victories and just adamant about it. And then Josh was a board member for MI Legalize and really pushed legalization ahead. And something we're going to talk about is he was very adamant about he was trying to put himself out of a job with legalizing because he had so many cases and what that looked like. And he was genuine about it and authentic. And then, you know, he's won High Times Trailblazer Awards just left and right. And here we are. I rent the redemption office out of Covert Law, and I love coming to work every day. I couldn't imagine working anywhere else now. So with that, Josh, you know, introduce yourself and maybe a little bit of, you know, what got you into cannabis lawyering, and you know, we'll take it from there. I also have some breaking news that I'm excited to talk about as well. So thank you.
Thanks. Yeah, thanks, Ryan. So I've been a lawyer for about 9 years, and for the large part of my career, I primarily did cases involving cannabis, either criminal defense or CPS type cases. And I got into doing that type of work because I grew up in a home where my parents used cannabis. And one of my part of the reason I really went to law school, and something that was like my kind of inspiration to become a lawyer, was when the thought of my mom possibly being arrested for cannabis use. And when I was in my 30s and thinking about what I kind of wanted to do in the next part of my life, I started thinking about someone like my mom going to jail for cannabis. And I don't in any way view my mother as a criminal or anybody that would go to jail. And so that was one of the things that really kind of drove me. I mean, I was a cannabis user myself, but it really wasn't, you know, thinking about myself. It was really thinking about someone like my mom or other people's parents. And that kind of got me to go in that direction. And so when I got out of law school, that's what I really put a lot of my time and effort into. I went to Cooley for a self-directed LLM for additional legal studies after I graduated. And I did self-directed studies on medical marijuana law. And that's kind of where I got started. I worked with Targowski and Grow in Kalamazoo. John Targowski and Dan Grow, those are both great marijuana attorneys here in Michigan. John now practices in California. But those are people that I really looked up to and worked with when I started out, and they taught me a lot. And then from there, I went to the Nichols Law Firm here in the Lansing area and was able to develop my own kind of practice there in regards to marijuana law. And things went really well. I'm really glad to be able to do the type of work I do. I really don't get a chance, and I'm glad for that, to represent many cannabis cases now. I very rarely get cases involving criminal charges in cannabis. And whereas I used to get several calls a day, I now rarely, you know, get a call. I might go a month or two sometimes without even really talking about a cannabis criminal case. And those things are great. Now I do a lot of licensing work and helping businesses get formed, businesses in the cannabis industry. And that's been great. So that's kind of who I am and why I do what I do.
Thank you. I know, Kevin, I know you have a lot of interest in the Bree case. Do you, you had a question?
Yeah. Yeah. Hey Josh, it's Kevin over at True Cannabis. You know, when I got to Lansing, big news was the Steve Green, and the Bree case. Can you talk about that? You worked a lot on that case. Like I said, it was big news when I got to Lansing, and it was a pivotal thing. So, can you talk to us just a little bit about that?
Yeah. That case really originated with, helping both, Steve and Maria with criminal charges they had in Oakland County. And at some point, apparently, based on from what we understand to be a complaint from Maria Green's ex-husband, that there was marijuana around the child, there became an investigation and they found out that there was criminal charges in Oakland County. And at that point, they went to remove baby Bree from her parents' care. And so I had already gotten to know Steve and Maria. And I was actually there the day that they took Bree from her mother, and watching that was very hard to watch. I was a new father myself. I've got children, two children right around Bree's age. And so I went ahead and decided to help represent them. Although at that point in my career, I was a pretty new attorney. I had never taken on a CPS case. I really didn't know much about CPS cases. I had a decent understanding of medical marijuana law and the defenses that you can present as a medical marijuana patient, but that was all in terms of criminal defense. And it's different when you have to deal with a CPS case. And so, but I just knew it was something I had to do because I knew that I could do it. And I really knew that I needed to get baby Bree back with her parents. And so, and I had a lot of help doing this. I mean, there are people that I really can say helped me a lot in terms of getting the media support behind the case. Also, other attorneys stepped up and helped me once I took the case on. I eventually had Dave Rudoy assist me with the case, and Dave Rudoy helped tremendously. And then also Dan Groh, who I mentioned earlier, had also agreed to help the Greens at trial. And I had Mike Nichols from the Nichols Law Firm helping me out. So with that case, essentially, it came down to the original reason they took the child from the home was the was something like that. When it's emergency order, you go in front of a referee. It's not necessarily a judge. And this referee said that because the Greens had medical marijuana, they grew medical marijuana, that there were that was valuable, and that people like to take valuable things, so that someone would could come in and rob them of their marijuana, and that presented a danger to the child. And that was the original reason the child was taken away. I mean, and that was crazy to me because, I mean, if you think about homes that have valuable items in them, aren't necessarily homes that you think of as dangerous places. You know, people have jewelry and items in their home that are worth just as much or more than marijuana plants. And the thought that those people could have their children taken was obviously absurd. And so the rationale that this referee used was absurd. But unfortunately, they did remove the baby Bree from their home. And like I said, that's kind of when I got involved with the case. And we were able to get the CPS and essentially the prosecuting attorney to back down and agree to give the child back without us making any any sort of admissions or concessions. And that was a big deal. Up until that point, CPS was treating marijuana, even medical marijuana, as a very bad thing. And after that case, I saw a shift in the way CPS handles cases. And CPS took a much more fair approach, and eventually, and shortly after, even changed their own manual. Their manual now states that medical marijuana use is okay unless it presents some other danger to the child. So I was a big step forward, and I was really, honored to be a part of that case and to be able to do what we did. Like I said, when I got into it, I didn't really know what was going to happen or how that case was going to kind of take off. I got involved because I was standing there when Bree got taken from her mom's arms and put in a police car and driven away. So, so thanks for asking about that case. And if there's any other questions, I'll certainly do what I can to answer them.
Yeah, Josh, I knew that was an important case. Steve Green was probably one of the most deserving people to have a medical card in Michigan at the time. He suffers from grand mal seizures and still doesn't even drive because of his condition. And to see them treat that particular situation that way, you can make the same argument that his prescription pharmaceutical drugs had value or whatever, So I really thought that was an important case that you challenged and won there. And I thought that was really impressive. One of the other things I wanted to mention, Ryan had mentioned that you do a lot of pro bono stuff. When I started out in Colorado, I went and talked to a lawyer because I had no concept of what was going on. And it was literally $500 to sit down and talk for 5 minutes and get some direction about zoning and things that now I know are just readily available. What motivates you to do pro bono work and not go out there and just try to kill it in a market where people are willing to throw money around?
It all goes back to why I became a lawyer in the first place. I didn't become a lawyer to make a bunch of money necessarily. I don't see money as maybe motivation, at least for me. Obviously you have to have money to take care of things and, pay your bills and provide for your children. But in terms of being one of my main motivating factors, it's not that. I think it's doing the right thing. And so I became a lawyer to do the right thing, not to necessarily make money. And I think a lot of times if you do the right thing, you'll be taken care of, and I've been able to provide for my children and take care of, my things. I've done a lot of cases pro bono, and I guess almost every time that's what it comes back to was just doing what the right thing. And I think a lot of times these people wouldn't have been able to get a lawyer that truly cared about them and their issues, or an attorney that knew how to defend a case properly in court. And I just knew there was a need. So, I stepped in. I did a trial that was about almost a week long up in Cadillac for someone that owned a dispensary. And I did that whole case pro bono. And again, it was one of those situations where I knew if I didn't do it, there'd be a public defender or someone else doing it that wasn't doing it for the right reasons and didn't necessarily even know how to do it to begin with. Where these are things that, I've been able to learn how to properly defend a cannabis case. So that's pretty much what it all comes down to me, is just doing the right thing.
Yeah, that's super great and really respectable. And definitely. I know that the community of Michigan really appreciates that. I think that, what I saw the difference between Colorado and Michigan is that the lawyers that stepped up and represented this industry in the beginning were activists. And I thought that was amazing, where in Colorado, we didn't see that. What I saw was people trying to take advantage of the situation. And I think that when you look at their law compared to Michigan's law and the way that we've rolled things out there, I think that you can really see that reflect in the way that things work today. So, great job on all that stuff. We really appreciate Thanks. It.
Yeah, I totally agree. When I was in law school, I went onto YouTube and found this video, and it was called Blazed and Confused. It was about an hour long YouTube documentary that was about the Michigan medical marijuana movement. And I was watching this while I was in law school, and I saw Matt Abel, John Turgowski, Neil Rockand, Dan Groh, Tom Levine. They were all in this documentary, and it was a very well put. I don't know if any of you guys have seen that or not, but if not, it's kind of, you should go back and watch it. It's obviously dated. It was about 9 or 10 years ago, but it's really well put together, and it kind of tells the story of where Michigan was back then. And I watched this in law school and was kind of in awe that these things were going on, that there were attorneys that were, you know, marijuana attorneys and really out there fighting these things. And I remember watching that and being like, wow, these guys are like so cool. And they are. I've gotten to meet all of them now, and they are very cool guys. I really look up to them. And so I had people to look up to when I was in law school that were already doing this, like Matt Abel. I mean, he's one of the ones I put out there first, because I don't know any other attorney in Michigan that put himself out there as a cannabis attorney when he did. And so I had people to look to as, you know, inspiration, and let me know that it was possible to do what I ended up doing. But I can even say, when I watched that video then, I still didn't necessarily think it was possible for me. It's one of those weird things is sometimes you watch people and you figure, oh, well, there's something that they have or know, or they know someone, or they did something that I can't do or I haven't done. So I can't necessarily be like that kind of lawyer. And I remember watching that video and like looking up to these guys, but not necessarily thinking I could do it, thinking that like, wow, it's hard. And it really, it just comes down to just believing in it and doing it. And that's kind of how I ended up becoming a cannabis lawyer. It wasn't necessarily planned. I didn't think it was possible for me to do it necessarily. It sounds weird, but I would just put two things up there. The only reason it really happens is because I think partly because there are people before me that have, you know, put themselves out there like that. And then also it just kind of happens, you know.
Yeah, and when shit happens, you need a good fucking lawyer. Can we swear on this thing, Ryan?
You're banned, dude. You're going home.
I don't know. I didn't read the instructions. Hey, Josh, this is Tom from Realty.
Facebook might.
All right, Tom. I apologize. What's up, man? Yeah, it's crazy how far we've come in the last 10 years. I mean, you and I met almost 10 years ago, and just hearing about you from the Free Bree case, and you know, the fact that you managed to get the improper transport statute under the MMMA, you know, thrown out in order to protect people who, you know, to travel with their cannabis, and you know, everything that comes along with being an advocate, you know, you need a good lawyer. And you know, it was easy for me to know who to contact when I needed help myself in that type of situation. I was wondering if you could talk a little bit about that, about the improper transport statute that, and how important was that as far as, you know, rights under the medical patient laws, that early in the days, it seemed like the law enforcement was trying every single way they could to blur the lines and still treat, you know, patients like criminals. So, and you were there right from the get-go, as far as I could tell, helping people out. So I just want to hear a little bit about that.
Yeah, that was quite a long process from when they created the statute to actually getting to the Court of Appeals and getting the Court of Appeals to determine that statute doesn't apply to medical marijuana patients. Every day across the state of Michigan, up until that point, people were getting arrested, putting in jail, having to get bonded out, put on probation, have to pee in a cup, all those things for a law that didn't apply to them. And it took quite a while, just that's the way things work. It's kind of strange in that if I win a case, and I go in and say, hey, look, this law doesn't apply to my client. And they say, huh, you're right. You know, I read it and you're right. I don't set precedent. And it continues every other place. And so although I was able to go around quite often and get them to dismiss a case because, you know, they agreed with me, it wasn't until I actually got a court to disagree with me that I was actually able to, you know, start making that change. And it took me having to go from the district court to the circuit court. And I lost in the circuit court. And I kind of knew going into this particular case that given the county it was, this is Clinton County, just north of Lansing. And I knew who the judges at the time were and the prosecuting attorney. I kind of predicted that this might be the one that I'm going to have to fight it all the way through to. And I did. Yeah. I argued it at the district court and I lost. And then I went to the circuit court and lost. And then we went up to the Court of Appeals. And at that point, we were able to make it where that law didn't apply to patients. That law was really poorly thought out. They put a law in the penal code that said that medical marijuana patients had to put their marijuana in a place that was inaccessible from the passenger compartment of the vehicle. And the Medical Marijuana Act allows you to transport marijuana. And the Medical Marijuana Act says that as long as you comply with this act, you can't be penalized in any manner. So essentially, you know, my argument was that this act doesn't state you have to put it in a certain part of your car. And this act says that you can't be penalized as long as you comply with this act. I don't really care what those other acts say. And essentially, that's what the Court of Appeals agreed with me on. And so that's one of the cases that I'm probably most proud of. I mean, the Bree one is right up there. Probably, you know, I'm probably more proud of that one in some ways, just because how connected I was to the situation and what was going on. And that's a very, you know, big implications. But the improper transport, like I said, saved people every day from getting arrested. And that is something that I really am glad I was able to help take part in. And now I haven't heard of anybody getting arrested for improper transport, you know, since that. I mean, that was December of, I don't even remember, like 16 or 17, 2016, something like that.
Yeah, it's kind of funny, Josh, how sometimes these rumors start in communities about interpretation of law. And they're started mostly a lot of the times by enforcement, you know, and it's funny until somebody's actually charged with somebody and challenges it, and never gets addressed. These things don't even get looked at. And I think this is a prime example with your marijuana having to be in a lockbox, which obviously was a in violation of our constitutional right. You know, and how many people got oppressed and bullied over an interpretation of a law that turned out to be completely incorrect?
Yeah, I know lots.
And listen to this
thousands
one, Josh.
Daily, I imagine.
Yeah, and I just found out there's somebody that has a improper transfer charge, transport charge, and that's what's holding them up to get employed under the Michigan in the new MMFLA, and that's what's holding them up. It's ridiculous. So like they've got an attorney that's addressing it, but that's holding up this guy's employment because he got an improper transport charge. It's just little stuff like that, and that's not a big. I mean, it is a big deal. It affects your life down the road, and then the laws we have now, the MMFLA was written by the legislature, so you know we have things like that in it. But I wanted to pivot here, and I'm excited to be able to talk about it with you, Josh. And you know, you can please just say obviously what you can and what you can't. But you've been working with the Bay Mills Indian Tribe, and you just opened up the first provisioning center and Northern Roots. It's exciting, it's cool, and it's really groundbreaking as far as the rest of the country and the world that the tribes get to do this. So if you can just tell us about it, how you're involved, what you can say, and how's it going and how's it work?
Yeah, it's been a great project to work on. I actually am a part owner of the Soil to Smoke Consulting. And what we are is a management company that manages campus facilities for federally recognized Indian tribes, and it's something that we had been approaching tribes about. And we spoke with Bay Mills, and they were interested in pursuing the cannabis industry. And so we have been their management company, and it was great to see this project take off. We went from 36 days from the creation of this agreement to opening doors for a retail facility. That included drafting the ordinance, creating, getting product, building out the dispensary, getting the license through the tribe, all of those things. And that's one of the great things about working with the tribe is we're not dealing with necessarily as much, you know, bureaucracy or red tape that we might see with a state agency like LARA. I mean, and that's nothing against LARA. LARA does a great job doing what they do. It's just kind of the inherent nature of government sometimes is we're dealing with a much smaller body of government when we're talking about a tribal council and the Bay Mills tribe. And we were able to really get a lot of things done fast, which is great. As a sovereign nation, they have the ability to create their own laws and rules on trust land and on essentially reservation. And so right now they have what is known as Northern Light Cannabis Company, and it's a dispensary up in Brimley on the reservation. And they currently sell adult use product, you know, to adults 21 and over. and we're doing great. We've been open for about 2 weeks now, and things are doing really well. We expect to work with other tribes. We're in discussions with a few other tribes throughout the state. Ultimately, and I'm not necessarily speaking on behalf of any tribe or the tribes, but it's my understanding that, and the way I, from our discussions, is that everybody wants to participate in the metric market down the road. And we don't necessarily want to do this to the exclusion of, the other market. We want to be able to work with the MRA or LARA, at least that's my intentions. And we want to be able to see, maybe tribal product intermetric, and also purchase metric product to sell at, tribal facilities. So it's kind of a, a win-win, just make the market bigger. And so that's something that, I've been really happy to work with, and something I'm going to probably hopefully stay busy, in the next year or so when we start working with other tribes. We have also talked with tribes across the country, not just here in Michigan, and we're, maybe hoping to work out some same or similar agreements with, tribes in Nevada, California, Washington, and a few other places.
Nah, that's awesome. I'm excited to hear about it and what's going on, and it just adds another layer to, the Michigan marijuana and cannabis scene and culture and everything. It's nice to be embraced. How does that going to work now? Say, as right now it's been real tough. Like, you get caught in the past and have a joint, like say at Soaring Eagle, and it's a big deal. They're making a big deal about getting bust on that. Is it now different if the tribes are involved in this, or how does that work?
So Bay Mills, originally, shortly after MRTMA was passed, created their own ordinance legalizing marijuana on the tribe. It's very similar to what we did here in Michigan. And so they were the first tribe in Michigan to take that route. And they did not go in terms of commercial licensing or, facilities, but in terms of, an individual possessing it, that became legal, a few years ago. So Bay Mills has done a really good job about being progressive when it comes to marijuana issues in the past. I don't know that other tribes have necessarily done that. Certainly, if they were to go forward with the adult use sales, I would expect them, and I don't imagine us working with them unless they were also creating an ordinance that would make it legal for people on the reservation to possess the cannabis.
What about now? There's stuff going on with merging the acts. It's not going to happen this year. Thank God we don't think so. Maybe later. And I know, talking with you, the attitude is we want to follow all the rules, not have any special favors, but possibly be able to do some cooler stuff, which is have a big show and grow, or some lounge that's at a grow. I mean, just really do some cool marijuana stuff, which, we talk about all the time. Is that, do you touch on that? Isn't that in the plans?
Yeah. I can't necessarily speak for the tribe, or, I don't represent the tribe. I work with the management company, but one of our desires, and I think we'll be able to get this accomplished. I think the tribe is looking at it the same way as that we are, and that we are able to maybe do some things that, like small tasting centers, smaller type, kiosk almost, places to sell cannabis that wouldn't be feasible under Michigan's licensing scheme. Maybe something small at the casino, things like that. And then events, also planning to own events to take place on tribal land, just similar to like the events that we've seen throughout the years here in Michigan with like the Cannabis Cup and things like that. But possibly developing their own sort of event center or places to have cannabis events. And we have, I think, a little more flexibility with licensing. And remember, I mentioned earlier how quick things can get accomplished. That doesn't really get reflected when we will talk about those same types of changes being occurred at the state level. So it's really great to work with them, and I think we'll be able to get a lot of neat things accomplished, like the tasting centers, events up there, and other things that we're still kind of thinking about.
Very cool. So I know, I remember even when we were having a documentary done leading up to 2018 election, these French filmmakers came over and we were in your office and talking to them. And yeah, it's the first time I heard you kind of really say it. And you might have said it, you probably definitely said it before, but it just resounded with me when you were talking about you know, I'm trying to legalize marijuana, and hopefully that puts me out of a job. You know, like you were truly believed it. You were doing what, maybe five cases a week, or getting five calls a week at the time, and it's disappeared completely since then. I see it. You know, it's crazy that when you hear about it, you know, there's still little stuff going on, but it's few and far between. So you definitely believed it. It wasn't, you weren't blowing smoke. And now I'm in the office, and if you know, it's you're talking about working with your management group, but also, you know, there's a lot of great clients that are in and out of here. I've had the pleasure of meeting, you know, and a lot of my friends have, you know, worked with you guys. The firm seems to be doing very well. Can you kind of touch on that, how you've been able to transition from doing the criminal defense to doing what you're doing now?
Yeah, you know, it's something that I kind of knew was coming, and I was working really hard to do away with the vast majority of cannabis criminal charges. And so I had also been working with MI Legalize, and part of that, people started asking me questions about, hey, when it becomes legal, what's it going to be like for licenses? You know, what is it going to take to get a license? And so I started having conversations way back when I was at the, you know, Nichols Law Firm with people about business questions and things like that. And so I eventually left the Nichols Law Firm so I could develop a practice that did more than criminal defense and that did also licensing work. It's always been my intention to keep doing criminal defense. And that's why I've always included other attorneys, and I have a staff of attorneys here at the office to do a lot of the licensing work, so that, you know, I can be available to take criminal defense cases as needed. I currently don't take or have very many. I can tell you, since November of 2018, I've had 3 phone calls involving caregivers and search warrants. I used to get 3 calls involving caregivers and search warrants on a week. And so we're talking 2 years, I've had a week's worth. It's great. I'm so glad that happened. And I'm glad I've been able to, you know, move the business in a different direction. And it's something I had already been doing and kind of envisioned. And so things are going great now, though. We represent over 100 different cannabis businesses here in Michigan in one respect or another. And we really have a great network of people we work with. And we can process applications and get people approved pretty quick. One of the things that I enjoy doing most now, if it's not, you know, criminal defense, is going to city councils and speaking on behalf of individuals that are requesting changes to an ordinance or for a city to opt in. And so that's something that I do a decent amount of now. But yeah, that's pretty much what's kind of happened, is I've went from a criminal defense attorney full time, traveling all across the state, 2 or 3 court appearances every day, to someone who has, you know, maybe 3 or 4 criminal cases at any given time now. Those that I do get that involve cannabis. Actually, let me go back too. I mentioned 3 search warrants since November of 2018. Those are the calls that have come in. 2 of those never even made it to court. One of them said, the prosecuting attorney said, hey, I think we can charge you with felonies, but if you let us know, or if you agree to let us come back in 30 days and check to see if you're compliant, we'll go ahead and agree not to charge you with any criminal charges at all. And so my client was like, all right, like, we'll let you come back in 30 days. And they never came back. They just wanted, you know, them to think they were coming back or whatever. One of my other cases, I was able to talk to the prosecuting attorney and able to get a civil infraction. It was a $150 fine, if I remember right. And the other case is still pending. So even those 3 calls that I've had have been treated much differently than they were in the past. In the past, those would have required several court appearances, filing motions, and a lot of other things. My practice has definitely changed. The criminal defense cases that I still do now mostly involved drugs driving. That still happens. People get accused of drugs driving. And right now I have, you know, 2 cases up in the UP, for instance, that I'm dealing with, and a few others throughout the state of Michigan. But that's pretty much all I do for criminal defense cases now. And mostly we do licensing work here at the office.
Josh, what do we do when we get pulled over and they want to give us a sobriety test for drug driving?
There's 2 schools of thought. Some said people say, go ahead and take the tests, show them you got nothing to hide, and you're going to do well on the test. I disagree with that. What I tell people is, don't take the tests. The officers are just going to try to find ways to say you failed the tests. These tests are hard to do for someone that's not familiar with the tests, and they're scored incorrectly quite often, or they're performed incorrectly. And so I'd tell people not to take the standardized field sobriety tests or any roadside or otherwise sobriety test. The only thing that you should take, and this is, there's again, there's maybe a different school of thought, but I say if they're going to take your blood and they ask to take your blood, you say yes. That's because in order for them to ask you to for your blood, you already have to be arrested. You have to be under arrest. So at that point, they've already arrested you for suspected drugged driving. If you refuse the blood test, they're probably going to get it anyway with a search warrant. And the blood test is going to come back and it's going to say, guess what? You have cannabis in your system. I don't know that I'm ever even going to be disputing that at a case if I were to go to trial. I mean, in some cases I could, but for the most part, I'm like, look, they have cannabis in their system. That's not what we're here to figure out. What we're here to figure out is, are they under the influence? And what under the influence means is, was the person's mental or physical condition significantly affected by cannabis, and was their ability to drive substantially lessened? And those words significant and substantial or substantially are important words, and that those words require a certain level of conduct on behalf of the driver. And you don't see that type of conduct where somebody's mental or physical condition is significantly affected to the point that it substantially lessens their ability to drive. And so I'm okay with somebody taking a blood test and it showing that there's cannabis. But if they ask you to take the roadside saliva test or any of those weird, like walk in a straight line, look at my finger with your eyes, any of that, you just say no, no, no. What that's going to do for me is, even if they arrest you, I'm going to be able to argue they didn't have probable cause to make that arrest, because they're going to be basing their decision off of the odor, your eyes, because they're always going to say they smell it, and they're always going to say the eyes were glossy and bloodshot. It's like in every single police report involving cannabis or alcohol, the odor and bloodshot and glossy eyes. But if that's all they have and you haven't admitted to using cannabis, they don't have you performing any standardized field sobriety tests, they're going to have a hard time showing that that's probable cause to make an arrest, and I could potentially get your evidence thrown out by challenging it. The blood test, just take it, because there's other consequences. If you don't take it, you could lose your license for 1 year.
That's good advice right there, Josh. Man, that's awesome to hear the positive and like the reduction in the caregiver and patient oppression that's happening right now versus when, you know, back in the early days of the MMMA. But thankfully, at a juggernaut like you, and it's great to hear that things have kind of calmed down there with that kind of stuff. So my question is, what's up with robots?
I like to do art. I like to draw, paint. When I started painting, I say I like to do it. I wouldn't say I'm very good at it. And I found that robots were pretty easy to do. You draw a couple squares. Nobody can tell you do it wrong, because like, it's a robot. If I put the arms a little low or one arm's a little longer than the other, it's like, hey, that's the way they built that robot. You can't tell me it's wrong, right? So that's kind of where I started doing robots from, because I enjoyed painting, but I really wasn't that great at it. And then I just, at some point, I think kind of went with it and started, you know, figuring out other ways to make a robot or other ones. And it kind of went from there. So yeah, that's it for me and robots.
I still have mine at my office at home, so that'll be in my marijuana museum someday. But that's about it for today's show. I know we got some hard outs. Kevin's about to get an inspection, hopefully passes. Good luck, Kevin, with that. Kevin, you have any final thoughts?
No, I just want to thank Josh for being on the show today. Thank him for all of his advocacy over the years. You're doing it the right way, brother. It's definitely being recognized. I know we haven't had a chance to work together directly on a whole lot other than, you know, some legislative stuff. But, you know, hopefully in the future we'll be able to connect on some things. And I wish you all the best moving forward, buddy.
Thanks. You too. Appreciate it.
Cool. Hey, Tom, any final words for Josh in the audience?
No, just echoing Kevin, you know, thank you for everything that you've done and keep on fighting the good fight. And hopefully when this COVID stuff shakes off or whatever, we can get together. It'd be nice to kind of get together at the lounge. I'd love to meet you over at Bay Mills, man. That sounds like really exciting stuff happening. So take care, brother.
For sure. All right. Thanks.
Josh, anything before we sign off? Parting thoughts? Words of wisdom?
you got me on the spot here. I don't know. Other than that, it was great to see all you guys and to talk and to have this conversation. So thanks for having me on. It's been great.
You got it. And with that, you know, I'm excited. I tell everybody, you know, I rent an office. Redemption's in a law office. And for people that don't know, Josh is a Michigan Cannabis Defender. They get a little different impression of what we do over here. It's I wouldn't want to work anywhere, be anywhere else. It's a fun spot, and it's definitely part of what we're trying to, you know, the history of marijuana, specifically in Lansing, and what we're trying to do to make Lansing the capital of marijuana. And Josh and James and the whole crew is a big, big part of it. So I'm excited about the future, and I enjoy coming to work every day. It's fun. I'm doing my dream job, and, you know, got a great office. So with that, you know, everybody, you know, that's listening on Facebook Live, you know, Josh has got a big audience, and anyone that's watching that, please go and, you know, follow us on Spotify, Podbeam, or iTunes, and you'll get the updates if you do miss the Facebook Live. So with that, I also do want to give a shout out to my favorite prosecutor, Carol Seaman. One again in Ingham County, and that's another part of what makes it so much fun to be working in Lansing. So with that, until next week, thanks everyone again, and we'll see you.
The Smoke and Rope Podcast is produced and hosted by me, Ryan Basor, the owner of Redemption Cannabis. Have ideas for episode topics or would like to be a guest on the show? Contact us at ryanb@redemptioncanna.com. Thanks for being along for the journey.